Thank you, Your Honor. As you said, Catherine Young, I'm from the Federal Public Defender's Office, and I'm representing Ashot Manasian. I would like to reserve about 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal, Your Honor. Mr. Manasian is appealing his conviction and his sentence for conspiracy to commit health care fraud. And the first issues I want to address are he contends that for various reasons, his guilty plea and or his appeal waiver are invalid. The first issue I want to talk about is our argument that the government breached the plea agreement. And I want to first outline this long-standing line of authorities that this court has, Johnson, Mondragon, Witness, and Morales at Heredia, which are in our briefs, and outline the principles that those cases state, that where the government agrees to recommend a sentence, any attempt by the prosecutor to influence the court to give a higher sentence is a breach. The government may not abide by its promise to recommend a particular sentence while also making statements that serve no practical purpose but to advocate for a harsher sentence. In such situations, the government has implicitly breached the plea agreement. When it offers to recommend a specific sentence, the government induces the defendant to forfeit constitutional rights in exchange for a united front. And the united front is more persuasive than just the defendant. The united front, this court has held, is the defendant's benefit of the bargain. So there's an implicit breach when the government agrees to recommend a low-end sentence, but then makes inflammatory comments that do not provide the district court...
Counsel, I could kind of see if the government had recommended, you know, if the parties agreed that here's the low-end and here's the high-end, the government's promising to recommend the low-end, and the government can't be making arguments to push them to the low-end. But here it seems a little different in the sense that the thing they didn't agree about, and I don't know that you even contest this, that they didn't agree about what could be the basis of, you know, the thing that would set the basis for the sentence at all. So the amount of money that had been taken from the government, and they didn't agree about that. They disagreed about that. So if the government thinks that he's coming in and making an argument that they disagree about trying to push them out down to the 200,000, I apologize if I'm getting the numbers quite a little wrong instead of like the 4.3 million-ish, plus or minus. If the government thinks that, are there any cases that involve that situation? Because what you're characterizing is the government arguing for not holding up their end of the bargain that they would recommend a lighter sentence, which they certainly did that implicitly or expressly, right? But I think you're kind of saying, yeah, but implicitly they're trying to push it up. But how do you distinguish from the fact that they were just that they legitimately could be pushing for the higher end of the money range in order to keep it up there where they wanted it, which I think they were allowed to do. So it seems like there's two different things going on here, I guess, is my, and are there any cases that involve that sort of circumstance where you've agreed to recommend a lower end of a sentence, but a lower end of a sentence that would be based on a higher amount of money at issue. And when the person comes in and tries to argue for the lower end of the money, the government seems to me should be able to say, no, we think it should be the higher amount. You see the difficulty I'm having with it?
I do see the difficulty, and I think it doesn't apply here because here you've got, and I was focusing on what happened in the middle of the sentencing proceeding. And at that point, the probation officer had already adopted essentially the government's sentencing range. So the parties are discussing the government's sentencing range. And that's the point at which the probation officer would recommend a high-end sentence based upon the government's range. So we're at a point in the hearing where the court is looking at the government's range and saying, based on a probation recommendation for a high-end, and then you look at what had happened to the previous defendant, Ms. Avetisian, who had been sentenced earlier. There, the probation officer had earlier adopted the government's range. The court adopted the government's range.
So I'm following you, but at that point, later in the proceedings you're talking about, is that at a point where the court couldn't, is it possible that the court could have said, you know, heard everything and still said, okay, I think that the dollar amount at this point, I agree with Mr. Manasian, it's the dollar amount's 200,000 or whatever that lower amount that he was arguing for. So therefore, I'm going to give him a much lower range than what the government had agreed to. Had that ship sailed in the sense of like, I know you think it had sailed, but what I'm asking is like, had it like, is there any way the court could have actually still adopted his arguments at that late date? I would have thought the court could, but tell me if I'm wrong about that.
you know, I don't see how it could have happened, because Mr. Manazian and Ms. Avetisian, or Ms. Avetisian had additional charges. There were two separate schemes. There was the Glazer scheme that you're going to hear about later, where his office was generating prescriptions for various types of things. And then Ms. Manazian, who was allegedly Glazer's office manager, was also decided to create this home health care agency, and she brought in Mr. Manazian, who owned a grocery store, to help her manage it. So Ms. Avetisian was charged with both the Glazer loss and the Fifth Avenue loss, which was the home health care agency owned by Glazer and Manassian. And, sorry, by Manassian and Avetisian. Okay, so Ms. Avetisian had already been sentenced, and the court had adopted wholesale the prosecutor's position on the amount of loss in Ms. Avetisian's case.
So your point is that, in theory, the court could have, you know, had an epiphany and changed his mind in between the two and said, you know, now I'm going to go with $200,000. But as a practical matter, that's a little bit hard for the court to do at that point, because the court's already sort of, for a co-defendant, sort of adopted the high end of the loss range.
Yes. I mean, the court had as to Fifth Avenue, Ms. Avetisian and Ms. Manassian were similarly situated. So once he had adopted it for her, he couldn't really go back. And the fact is also that when Mr. Manassian's counsel came forward and said, well, we'd like you to consider that there were, in fact, legitimate aspects of Fifth Avenue that we'd like the court to consider, and therefore, you know, the law shouldn't be what the government alleges, the court goes on to say, you know, I'm having a hard time with that because of the light box. And the light box was used for copying all over, and that was a hallmark of fraud. And the argument that I'm making about the government's breach of the plea agreement is that the government then said, yes, Your Honor, the light box is a hallmark of fraud. And so that's exactly squarely within this line of authorities, where it makes an inflammatory comment that there's a hallmark of fraud, and it doesn't provide the district court with any new information, and it doesn't correct factual inaccuracies.
Now, can I ask about that, counsel? Because, you know, I'm not a former prosecutor or defense attorney, so I don't, you know, it's a little bit, but trying to think, you know, I went back and read the record. I'm looking at it right here, ER 20. But I have stood in front of judges, right? And when a judge, and so this is the same judge, if I recall correctly, that had actually overseen the Glazer trial. And you're saying, well, the government's saying stuff that's inconsistent with the Glazer trial. But this judge was actually overseeing the trial. So it occurred to me that the judge is actually, the judge heard all this stuff, right? And obviously the judge did not agree with the government's position based on what the judge says. Because it's not like the government just brings up the light box sua sponte, right? The judge is the one that's saying, I'm really worried about the light box. Light box bugging me. The light box is this. And then the government comes back, and all I could find that the government said is what you've latched on to. But the government says the court has already noted. So the government's basically, I mean, what I'd be tempted to do as an advocate, right? Like, I'm not going to argue with you, judge. And so it says the court's already noted the light box was found there. And Dr. Artanian's blank signed prescription pad. So the problem I'm having with your argument is you're really focusing on the light box and inconsistency with the government's argument in Glazer earlier. But two things. The one is that all the government was really doing was saying, you know, I'm not going to disagree with you, court. As the court, you've already said this, right? I mean, that's what they – but not just that, but they're linking it with a blank signed prescription pad. And if you were to ask any of us and whether or not – you know, if you're investigating a Medicaid fraud scenario, are a blank signed prescription pad and a light box, quote, hallmarks of fraud? I mean, I think it's hard to say that those aren't. I mean, the government's not saying a whole lot other than saying those two things were found there and they're hallmarks of fraud. So that's it's not just the light box. It's not like the government brought it up by themselves. It's the government only repeating after the court's really pounded on it and linking it with something else. So it's a little bit hard for me to. You see what I'm saying? I'm having trouble with. What are your thoughts in response to that? I just having trouble with getting where you're at on it.
All right. Well, at one point, Your Honor, I think you said you thought that the court had remembered the trial. And I think that there were occasions in the past hearing where the court said, I don't really remember what happened at trial. I don't think the court remembered the agent's testimony, because the court, to the court, it was one trial out of many. To the prosecutor, it was the witness that they had put on at trial. So I'm not sure that he accurately remembered what had transpired at trial.
Who brought up the light? Maybe this will help me. Who brought up the light box first, the court or the prosecutor?
The court brought it up first, and the defense counsel was arguing, well, there were legitimate claims here, and they worked hard to make this a legitimate operation. And the court said, well, I'm having a hard time with that because of the doggone light box. And the court went on and on about the light box. You know, and so our point is, at that point, it's clear he's not getting a low-end sentence. And the government's agreed to
it. Your argument has got to be that even though the court brought it up first, and you know, if I'm the government counsel, I'm sitting there thinking, well, the court obviously didn't buy my argument that I was making in the Glazer trial, a couple weeks ago. And so at that point, but the government has to keep, I mean, you see how struggle I'm struggling with. Does the government have to keep mum, or you might call it admirable, flexible trial strategy, you know, for the government to say, okay, the court didn't buy my argument, so I'm going to go with I'm going to agree with the court at that point. It's hard for me to see how that's misconduct by the government, as opposed to just saying, well, the court didn't buy it, so I'm going to go with what the court's saying.
Okay. Well, I don't think there's any reason for the court not to have bought it, because it was the unrefuted testimony of the government's case agent that she had scrutinized all the files. She knew the indicia of tracing. She described the indicia of tracing, and she said there was no tracing at Fifth Avenue. So I think that the court just didn't recall that testimony, because the court was saying at the sentencing, well, there was tracing all over the place at Fifth Avenue. There was no indication of any tracing at Fifth Avenue. So that was an error. But our point is, first, that once under these cases that we've cited, the government can't make inflammatory comments that don't provide new information or correct factual inaccuracies. And clearly the court saying, yes, it's a hallmark of fraud, didn't give the court new information, didn't correct factual inaccuracies. So even if it were true, it would have been a breach of the agreement under this court's precedence. But we're arguing it clearly wasn't, because the government had put its own case agent on the stand to testify against Dr. Glazer. I've looked at all the files. I know what tracing is.
Counsel, if I could just jump in, what remedy are you seeking for this?
Mr. Manassian wants to withdraw his plea.
But, okay, do you have any case law that says for a breach of a plea agreement based on this, where low-end sentence versus high-end sentence lets you to get out of your plea?
I think one of the cases, and I don't remember which one, does says that the defendant has the option of withdrawing the plea or vacating the appeal waiver.
Isn't the remedy here just remand for resentencing?
Well, I think that in general, plea agreements are governed by contract law. And in contract law, I think a non-breaching party has the option of declaring the entire contract or only a portion of the contract breached.
Do you know what case would permit the defendant to undo their whole plea based on a sentencing error?
There is one of the cases that I cited, I think, that does that, and I'll have to look for that.
Well, I just asked because let's say exactly the same thing happened, same comments about the light box, and the court sentenced to 63 months. So this is the exact sentence the government was advocating instead of the 78. But same thing was said. Would you still be able to then invalidate the plea because of what the prosecutor, how the prosecutor answered the question?
Well, I think in that case, there is a question of there's no prejudice.
Well, then it seems to me if the prejudice issue is the sentence, then you would remand for sentencing, not to undo the plea.
No, I understand what you're saying. I mean, I'm just saying that I think that if there is a breach, then it's the defendant's option to decide which remedy he's selecting. And then there's another argument that we're also making with respect to the probation officer recommending a high-end sentence based upon the allegation that the loss was apparently much greater than the loss the government requested. And the probation officer said that her analysis was based on the indictment, the plea agreement, and materials provided by the government. And it clearly wasn't in the indictment or the plea agreement, because as I've said, there were two separate schemes alleged in the indictment. Mr. Manassian was only alleged to have participated in Fifth Avenue. And $4 million in change was the entirety of Medicare proceeds of Fifth Avenue. So that suggests that the probation officer was relying in recommending a high-end sentence on something the government had given them, some materials the government had given them. And my argument, and I know this isn't encompassed within the strict framework of the cases as my previous argument was, but in such a situation where the probation officer was recommending a high-end sentence based upon information purportedly from the prosecutor, and the prosecutor knows that it's not true, that there were no losses for Fifth Avenue over and above the $4 million that was the discussion in the PSR, that the prosecutor has an obligation to correct that error. And so in that claim, Manassian argues that his conviction and or his appeal waiver should be vitiated. Mr. Manassian also argues that his plea is unenforceable because it was not knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. And here we're arguing on the fact that there, the reasonable expectation of the parties in a plea agreement is that he will be the defendant will be provided a sentencing process that's in accordance with the rules and the sentencing guidelines. And here you have an express dispute in the plea agreement and the plea colloquy. And instead, when we get to sentencing, the court says, if loss has been disputed from day one and efforts to sit down with the prosecutor and try to reach an agreement fails, then pleading guilty is just exactly the wrong thing to do.
So can I say about that counsel? I understood your argument on that, but it's also true that your client did waive his appeal rights unless he got above a certain, 79 months, offense level 25, 4.3-ish million or something like that. And what I'm struggling with is, in any kind of contractual situation, if I basically say he specifically waived the right to challenge the process unless it was above this number, right? And essentially what you're saying, and he didn't get above that number, and you're saying, well, he expected that he would get a certain process, but he actually waived that process unless it was above a certain number. So how do I not sort of hold him to the bargain that he made. It's a tougher situation, I think, where you haven't actually. It's a tougher situation where you haven't set that upper limit. When you've agreed to that upper limit, then I feel like it's a little bit difficult to say he didn't know that it was possible that he could get a 79-month sentence and that it would be based on a process he didn't like.
No, I understand what you're saying, and just say that incorporating the plea agreement was the agreement and understanding that he would be sentenced under the rules and the sentencing guidelines. And then instead, when they got to the end of it, the court said, you know, if you wanted to contest the amount of loss, you shouldn't have pled guilty, which clearly violates the rules and the sentencing guidelines. That's not what they intend. And so I understand what you're saying, but I'm saying that apart from that, there's a certain assumption. The defendant is entitled to the benefit of his bargain, that he will get a process that's not off the rails, that does comport with the rules and the sentencing.
I'm sympathetic to that argument, but I just feel like off the rails in this context is 79 months and one day or 4.29 or whatever. You know what I'm saying? That's the part I'm struggling with, but I hear your argument.
Okay, I understand. Well, I've only got 2 minutes left. I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal. So unless there are any questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Yeah, I have no questions, Judge Owens.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
No questions. Thank you, counsel. And now, going with Ms. Hostetler.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Kelly Brooke Hostetler, and I represent the United States. Manassian has waived all of the claims that he brings before this court, except his claims that his plea was involuntary or that the government breached the plea. Neither of those claims have merit, and therefore he has waived all of his remaining claims before this court. His claim that his plea was involuntary because he was not properly told that the government had to prove that he had the intent to deceive and cheat rather than the intent to deceive or cheat fails because the entire essence of his scheme was to procure funds from Medicare to which he would otherwise not be eligible because of the kickbacks, as he agreed in his plea. Moreover, the government did not breach the plea. The government consistently asked the court to sentence Manassian at the low end of the range. The government did not use gratuitous or inflammatory language in either its sentencing memorandum or before the court. It reserved the right to argue for the loss.
Can you respond to your opposing counsel's argument that sort of the by the time the government's using some of this language, you've already got the co-defendant sentenced under the high loss amount, so the government really shouldn't be in there talking about the high loss amount anymore because it's pretty much a done deal. I think your argument is you can't rely on that as a reason to be arguing for to be saying anything that will cause his sentence to be higher.
It would seem odd to me that because the judge made a decision in an individualized determination about one defendant, that the government then is bound to not make any argument on the loss.
It would seem odd, but it seems like here it would seem odder if the court had said in the first case, you know, 4.3 million, and in the second case, 2 million. That would seem I think we might be getting claims from one part or the other that's irreconcilable.
Well, the judge didn't walk in saying, I've already made up my mind because I've heard this other hearing. The judge was listening to Manassian, was open to his claims. You know, for example, he argued that the Medicare contractor wasn't reliable, that Manassian argued that the Medicare contractor wasn't reliable. The judge seemed interested in that argument. It wasn't clear, in fact, that it would be exactly the same. And it would seem odd for the government just to have to sit on its hands when Manassian is making all these arguments about Fifth Avenue. The judge could have changed his mind.
Counsel, I asked opposing counsel about any case law saying if there was an error on the 63 versus 78 in light of the government's representations, and please don't read into that, but I think that it was. I'm just trying to understand what the remedy was. Are you aware of any case law that says in that situation you can undo the plea and basically it's the whole case can be retried?
You're asking that if the government did in fact breach the plea, what is the remedy?
Correct. In a sentence, right. If they breach a plea in a sentencing context, can you basically get out of your plea?
Well, I do think in Payas Reynoso 68 F3rd 482, this court has indicated that if the government does breach the plea agreement, the defendant has a choice to have resentencing or to have the plea vacated.
Okay, I'll take a look at that one right now. Thank you.
Also, just on the light box question, we do not believe the government took an inconsistent position between the Glazer-Moreno trial and the Manassian hearing. Special Agent Lee testified at Glazer's trial that the light box was unusual. It was part of what they found in this when they conducted the search of the office. It is true the government did not find evidence of tracing, but that doesn't mean that the government believes that no tracing went on. And Glazer continued to argue that tracing did go on. The government did not rely in its closing at Glazer's trial to rebut his claims that tracing had gone on Agent Lee, Special Agent Lee's testimony, because the government believed that the light box was unusual and did indicate fraud. Just we didn't have any physical evidence to demonstrate that.
I assume an analogy would be in a bank robbery case, if there were instructions on how to blow up a vault, but the bank robbers did not actually blow up a vault. The fact that the bank robbers did not blow up a vault doesn't mean that there's an instruction manual at the house about how to blow up a vault. That is an indication of bank robbery planning of some sort going on, even though maybe in this particular time they didn't blow the vault.
That's an apt analogy, Your Honor.
That is a good analogy. I was thinking of when I was a kid and got caught with bubble gum and a lighter, and my parents thought I was might be trying to smoke, even though I didn't get caught with any cigarettes. But sort of the same thing that you, because you're right. The statement was that two things together were a hallmark of fraud, if I understood correctly, right? Not just the light box, but sort of the combination of the light box and a signed prescription pad.
Correct. The judge did not rely simply on the light box. He did talk about the signed prescription pads, which are very troubling.
I mean, my understanding, the government didn't talk only. It kind of linked them together and said those things together were hallmarks of fraud, sort of along with what Judge Owen said, just their mere presence, whether they were used or not, is a hallmark of fraud.
Correct. We therefore believe those challenges to his plea and are not meritorious, and therefore he's waived all of his remaining claims. The court has no further questions. I would ask this court to affirm.
I do have one question following up on the case that you mentioned, and I need to look at that one more closely. But a case that 68 F3rd was decided pre-Booker, so that was when guidelines were binding and so forth. Are you aware of any cases under a 3553 regime where the guidelines are not binding, where courts are no longer stuck, that says that would carry out that idea that you would be able to invalidate a plea?
No, I'm not sure of any. I'm not aware of any since.
Thank you. Well, one more follow-up question. In a 3553 context, when you have to talk about the nature and characteristics of the defendant, do you know of any cases that take our previous breach of a plea due to prosecutorial, I'll call it misconduct, or breaching the plea agreement by them saying one thing that's inconsistent with the plea agreement, that has occurred in the context of analyzing the 3553 factors? And here's why I asked the question. I know it's a tough question. You probably weren't expecting it, but a lot of our case law, this is an esoteric discussion, and maybe we're not going to decide in this case, but a lot of our case law about plea agreements and loss figures and clear and convincing was all the time when the guidelines were binding. And we are no longer in that world, and we haven't been in that world for 15 years. And I think we're the only circuit that still keeps latching on to these clear and convincing and all of these things. The other circuits have moved on because the guidelines are simply advisory. And so I guess what I'm trying to understand is that, you know, are there any cases that say breaching a plea agreement by arguing guideline calculations one way or the other, which are advisory, is still true in a Booker world where what really is supposed to matter at sentencing is the 3553 factors and not 2B1.1 and all these constructs that we still have to go through? I'm just curious because I've seen the department sometimes argue that clear and convincing and loss, for example, should no longer exist because it's been overruled by Booker, but sometimes they don't argue that. So I was just curious if I've missed any cases on this.
We did argue that in this case. We did argue that.
Yeah.
In this case, what should have been standard. As this court acknowledges in its cases, its line of reasoning on that isn't necessarily perfectly clear. But that where there is a conspiracy and the increased loss is based on the extent of the conspiracy, this court has held that it only needs a preponderance of the evidence and not a clear and convincing standard.
I think that's the Treadwell case that Judge Gould wrote.
Correct. Treadwell and Berger, yes.
I don't have any more questions. Thank you for the indulgence.
Thank you, Your Honor. If there are no further questions from anyone else on the panel.
Judge Van Dyke?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
And no questions here.
Thank you. We ask the court to affirm.
Thank you. So, Ms. Young.
Thank you, Your Honor. So one of the issues that was discussed was the standard for a conspiracy case. And there are six elements of the Johnson standard. One of them is conspiracy, and it was also discussed, and the last two are the ones that have been found to apply most often, most recently, and those two both apply here. Also, in a conspiracy case, it's generally found that the reason the lower standard applies in the conspiracy case is because the extent of the conspiracy has been proven or has been pled, and that isn't the case here. With respect to the 3553 issues, Morales is a post-Booker case, and I think that in this case they're discussing the extent of the guidelines, and often the courts do feel, practically speaking, bound by the guidelines, so I think that still applies even in a 3553, even a post-Booker analysis. The prosecutor also argued that the government doesn't believe there were no tracing, but that's the position the government took. You know, we briefed some cases about taking inconsistent and contradictory positions against different defendants. That's the position they put their case agent on the stand to testify to.
Counsel, I don't necessarily disagree with that. I guess I think, as you may have heard in our, the difficulty I'm having is that something can still be a hallmark, especially in combination with something else, and not be inconsistent with it not having been used. So that's the difficulty. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I understand what you're saying, but in this case, the court went on for some length about how he was rejecting the defendant's position that there was a legitimate operation here because he can't get over the doggone light box. So he was really obsessed with the light box. And instead of taking him down from it when he's clearly heading for a high-end sentence, the prosecutor encourages him. And, you know, under the Johnson, the Morales Heredia standards, it wasn't new information. It wasn't correcting factual inaccuracies. It was something inflammatory that encouraged the district court to go higher rather than to walk back. And the agent's testimony in the Glazer trial was that she had scrutinized all the Fifth Avenue files. She knew what tracing was. She couldn't find it. So I think that that makes it a breach, that the government should not have, certainly should not have encouraged the district court to believe it's a hallmark of fraud. And we also argue in other claims had an obligation to correct that misunderstanding.
Counsel, going back to the, I think you cited Heredia.
Yes.
That was a C1C case where the parties agreed to the sentence. This was not that type of case. So do you have any cases that are not C1Cs?
I don't know. I'll look at that and be happy to brief it if you're part of the ones. And then just briefly, the prosecutor is saying that the entire essence of this scheme was criminality. Mr. Manassian said consistently from his plea to the fact that he tried to withdraw his plea before trial that he believed Fifth Avenue had provided legitimate services 4 days before his sentencing. He tried to withdraw his plea because he said, my attorney has not contacted a single one of my patients to determine that I actually provided legitimate services. The defendants believed they provided legitimate services at Fifth Avenue, and that was the essence of their defense. I think I'm over now, so unless there are any more questions, I'll submit.
I'm good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm going to thank Ms. Young and Ms. Hostetler for the fine arguments. This case will now be submitted. Then the parties will hear from us on Manassian's appeal in due course.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Okay, so we go on to the Moreno and Glazer cases. And we have two different appellants here. So who's counsel for Moreno?
Your Honor, good afternoon. Edward Robinson. I'm counsel for Moreno.
And for Glazer?
Your Honor, Carl Gunn. I'm representing Dr. Glazer.
Okay, so I think because we had 20 minutes, we thought we would give each of you 10 minutes for your arguments. And if you wanted to make rebuttal, you could stop before that's all used up. Although if you wanted to have an agreement, one of you would do rebuttal for both to do that also. So, how does it sound to the advocate?
Your Honor, we've actually, Mr. Robinson and I have talked, and we'll each take 10 minutes with me going first, if that's all right with the court, and we'll save our separate rebuttal time. I'm going to save 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, so we'll proceed. That plan will set the clock for each of you at 10 minutes separately, and if we indulge one of you to go over, it won't detract from the other opponent's time.
Great, Your Honor. Thank you very much. Your Honors, as I just said, I'm representing Dr. Glazer. The concern here is that Dr. Glazer didn't get a fair trial or a fair sentencing for a number of reasons. It was partly because there was an abdication of judicial control in selecting the alternate jurors. It was partly because the court promised that what was said in the in-camera hearings wouldn't be used or would stay confidential and then use that in choosing a role enhancement for the sentence. It was partly because there were multiple evidentiary errors, the most dramatic of which was putting Dr. Glazer in the position of calling elderly patient witnesses liars. There's lots of evidentiary issues here, and I really am, I'll address whatever individual errors the court wants me to address, but I do want to touch on the cumulative prejudice and just make clear how these things all added up, because the errors here really intertwine and add to each other. First, you have errors that undercut the defense attack on the government evidence in theory. You have the agent's opinion that there was no evidence of tracing, that undercuts the defense explanation of probably one of the most damning pieces of evidence, Dr. Glazer's signature being on these blank forms. You have the exclusion of evidence of legitimate care. That undercuts a challenge to what the government called in its theory a, quote, assembly line of fraud, unquote. You have the exclusion of a Medicare hospital regulation. That undercuts the defense challenge to the testimony about Medicare regulations. Then you have a series of errors that undercut the credibility of the most important defense witness, Dr. Glazer. First, he gets put in the position of calling elderly, sympathetic patient witnesses. They weren't telling the truth. That's been found just by itself to be plain error in three of this court's cases. But there's more here. You have his own business manager saying what he told the Medicare investigators was a lie. He gets the challenging questioning from the court that's described in the brief. He's not allowed to use his notes to refresh recollection. There's what I, if I can make up a word, there's ungatekeeped expert testimony about a home health care regulation that contradicts the standard that Dr. Glazer said he used. And third, you have a series of errors that introduce other inadmissible opinion or hearsay evidence. You have opinions about things that are, quote, red flags, unquote, with little or no explanation about why or how they're red flags. Just basically an opinion that they show he's guilty. You have this education letter that refers to, quote, findings, unquote, of what is essentially fraud, has a lengthy summary of the law, and then assertions about documents that have been provided to Dr. Glazer. You have testimony about not just that there was a warrant and probable cause, but that the probable cause was based on, quote, allegations of services not rendered and interviews of beneficiaries that by implication supported the probable cause and showed some sort of guilt. All of those things, Your Honor, were errors for the reasons that I've talked about. The government says, well, gee, it's okay because the evidence was overwhelming. The evidence wasn't overwhelming. For one thing, if the evidence was so overwhelming, why did the jury acquit Dr. Glazer of one count? We know it's not overwhelming, at least on that count. And look at what the government points to, Your Honor. Let me talk about why it's not overwhelming. They point to Zoila O'Brien, inside cooperating witness. Well, I don't think a cooperating witness is ever going to be overwhelming because any cooperating witness, the defense can argue she's saying what the government wants to hear. You had the patient witnesses, but the patient witnesses were contradicted by Dr. Glazer. You have these duplicate EKGs. They're EKGs that if you put them right next to each other, you'll see they're the same, which is presumably what the agent did. But Dr. Glazer wouldn't have been putting those together one by one, one by each other. He'd be seeing them on different days, on different appointments. You have a large percentage of referrals to Fifth Avenue Healthcare, which the government makes much of. Frankly, I find it perfectly plausible that a doctor will have a preferred provider. They think this is a good healthcare agency and they're going to send lots of their patients there. You have the pattern of fund transfers that the government says is suspicious. It's not suspicious. That's a pattern you might expect if you have someone who's being financially backed up by someone else and they don't have the cash flow. So they pay them as the money comes in. And in fact, that's exactly what the business manager who testified said was going on.
Hey, Mr. Gunn, if I could just jump in, because it seems to me in this case, and this applies also to Mr. Robinson, to your client as well, is that there are a lot of issues in the case you guys have raised. Then there's also this, the lack of evidence. And, you know, the prosecutors didn't prove its case. And so let's say, again, this is all hypothetical. I'm just trying to process this case. There are a lot of issues in this case.
Yes, there are.
If there's a lack of evidence, if that's what we find, then this case can't be retried, correct? It'd be double jeopardy and it's over.
That's correct as to Mr. Robinson's client. I'll let him address that. But I haven't argued insufficient evidence, Your Honor. I agree a jury could have found Dr. Glazer guilty. If they believed the government's theory and believed the government's take on the evidence, there was enough to convict.
Well, since I've got you here, let me just ask you this question. This is more a question for Mr. Robinson, but let me ask you since you're here. When we analyze the Virginia standard, are we allowed to look at other errors that were involved? In a sense, is there a Jackson versus Virginia review mixed in with cumulative error. So let's say we think that the judge did make mistakes A, B, and C, not enough to maybe on their own reverse a conviction. But if we get to the Jackson question and we think that the evidence on Marino was really close, can we look at, is there like a cumulative Jackson analysis that you were aware of?
Your Honor, I haven't thought about that, and I don't want to tread on Mr. Robinson's case or client. But let me address that in the context of...
Sure, go ahead.
In my case, I'm not arguing Jackson versus Virginia. I don't think I could, so I haven't. What I am arguing is cumulative error. And look at what we have here. First of all, we have the prosecutorial misconduct of the improper cross-examination, which three of this court's cases have held as plain error by itself. But on top of that, we have all the other errors. And, Your Honor, I've listed, I think, six or seven or eight. But, frankly, with cumulative error, I frankly think you only need the improper cross-examination. And you certainly don't need all of those errors I've argued to find cumulative error that adds up here. Remember, in my case, there's also the problem with the alternate juror selection, and that, of course, would require reversal regardless of any cumulative error. It does depend on my argument that it's a structural error, but I think when you have this sort of abdication of judicial control, it really is. I mean, see, what do we have? We have basically three members of the audience being delegated to select the alternates with no idea what sort of standard they use. That's, if there's an abdication of judicial control, it seems to me that's it. So I'll say that in response to the court's question, which is
thank you.
A little bit of a different way. I see I'm down to 2 minutes. I'm happy to address any questions on any of the specifics. I didn't really go into them because there's so many of them, I wasn't going to have time to touch on them all.
Let me ask Judge Owens, Judge Van Dyke, do you have any immediate questions?
No, thank you.
Nor do I, but if you feel you need more time, I'd give you an extra 2 minutes.
Thank you, guys. I'll hold it and see what the prosecutor says.
Okay, let's now go to Mr. Robbins.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Ed Robinson, I represent Ms. Marino. I'm going to endeavor to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Judge Owens, let me try to answer the question that you posed to Mr. Gunn this way. We've argued that there's insufficient evidence to sustain this conviction because as indicted in this case, Ms. Marino's an aider and abettor, she's a marketer, and the government failed to prove that she knew of the discrete fraud in this case, the billings for services not rendered and for the medically necessary services under the Medicare regulations. We've also argued that the government, because they could not prove that connection, abandoned that theory, and this is our constructive amendment argument. They proved up an uncharged kickback in the colloquial term, arrangement between Ms. Marino and the providers. And where I don't know of a case where combined legal error with a sufficiency argument that may fail by a certain increment
right.
To a jeopardy type bar to a later prosecution. I won't spend too much time on that if you don't mind. What I'd like to do, though, is focus on how in this case, it's like the Choi case. The government understood during the course of their presentation of this case with respect to Ms. Marino that they couldn't prove that as an aider and abettor or as a co-conspirator as defined in the indictment where she's seeking to induce the providers to file these false claims, that she had any knowledge, never mind prior knowledge, of this discreetly pled scheme, the billing scheme. And so what the government did with the assistance of the erroneous jury instructions is argue to the jury, particularly in their rebuttal argument, that Ms. Marino was an aggressive marketer and that she should have known something wasn't right about that, when she was interviewed by the agent post-search warrant, she said that she knew there was something wrong, or at least she lied about her involvement as a marketer. And that cover-up sufficed as the intent to defraud evidence necessary to support a claim of health care fraud. Where I think this court can determine that there may be a combination of insufficiency and legal error is the intent to deceive or cheat instruction. There are really three instructions that we rely on as the judge's error, which facilitated the government's constructive amendment argument on the uncharged kickback theory, and that's the willful blindness, the willfulness out of the regulations which support the criminal liability for the claims for medically unnecessary services. But looking at the intent to deceive or cheat argument, the parties agree that the court was wrong in instructing the jury with respect to intent to defraud using the disjunctive deceive or cheat from Sean Miller. The government argued in their rebuttal that Ms. Marino was acting willfully and knowingly because when she was interviewed by Agent Lee after the execution of search warrants, she lied about her involvement in the clinic. But her lies about her involvement in the clinic really only went to her being a marketer. The government charged, what the government claimed was a theory of healthcare fraud, but it was uncharged Title 42 conduct, if you will. This jury was asked to convict Ms. Marino based upon her deceiving the agent about her involvement as a marketer. They could have returned a guilty verdict against Ms. Marino for that deceit, but that's not what 1347 calls for. 1347 calls for an intent to deceive or cheat with respect to false claims, make money or property from the Medicare system. There was no evidence of that. Now, again, the constructive amendment argument and the sufficiency argument appear to be coextensive. And so I'm not going to parse that. I'd ask the court to adopt the sufficiency argument as more favorable to Ms. Marino. But the fact of the matter is, given the state of this record, and most importantly, given the fact that the government abandoned any claim that or any argument that Ms. Marino knew about or somehow facilitated these false claims submitted to Medicare, we don't know, and the record isn't clear, what theory this jury relied on in order to convict Ms. Marino. The government has to establish harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt in order to cure or argue that this error, which is conceded with respect to the intent to deceive or cheat instruction, is harmless. And because there was a general verdict in this case, and we do not know what theory this jury relied on in order to convict Ms. Marino, for the arguments made by the government in combination with the erroneous instructions by the court, there's insufficient evidence. There's also a constructive amendment. If you look at the manner in which the government argued this case, both in their answering brief and in their rebuttal argument at trial, the government said, look, you can see that based upon Ms. Marino's aggressive conduct and her being somewhat deceitful with respect to that marketing conduct with Agent Lee post-search warrant, she had the intent to deceive, and therefore she's guilty of healthcare fraud. The judge gave the deliberate ignorance instruction, and he gave that, and that facilitated the government's argument that a reasonable person should have known that marketing these elderly patients for due to their Medicare benefits was unlawful in some way, albeit not charged in this indictment, trying to satisfy the willfulness element. Well, there was no evidence that Ms. Marino had a subjective knowledge of the charged fraud. She didn't know about the billing scheme. She knew nothing about any billing. She's a 62-year-old woman who's worked hard her entire life and has done this type of marketing for other businesses since she's been in the United States. When the government had the opportunity through Zoila O'Brien, the so-called insider, to ask, what did you talk with Ms. Marino about with respect to the billings of the clinic? Didn't even ask that question because they knew there was no evidence to support that. I see that I have 2 minutes left, and I'll reserve that for rebuttal unless the court has any additional questions for me.
Hey, counsel, I have a question, if you can indulge it, and I'll give you a little extra time to make up for it.
Thank you.
Sometimes, just as speaking as one judge, I have a challenge in this or other kinds of cases to see the forest for the trees when there are so many issues raised. So I just wanted to ask you, as an advocate for your client, could you please tell me what Marino thought exactly she thought she was doing and what she either didn't know or didn't think she was doing?
She knew that she was recruiting people who may be Medicare beneficiaries, who may receive services at the clinic, and from those services she would get paid money. That's what she knew, and we conceded that at trial and took no different position. But to answer your question just a bit more broadly, Your Honor, at the time that she was doing this, I doubt the government could prove willfulness even with respect to the Title 42 uncharged kickback. There was no evidence, and she did not know anything about the billing, and most certainly she didn't know anything about the Medicare regulations, which vary due to geography and are subject to an internal appellate process because the doctors disagree over what is a medically necessary service. And mind you, these are earwax removal, allergy tests, that kind of thing. And she never even knew anything about that. And so I hope that I answered your question, Your Honor.
Yes, you did. Thank you. And I used up your 2 minutes rebuttal, so I'll give you an extra 2 minutes rebuttal so you can plan on.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, so now I think that concludes the arguments by appellants, and I think we'll hear from Ms. Hotstetler again.
Yes, Your Honor, may it please the court. The government put on sufficient evidence that Marino was a conspirator in a conspiracy to commit healthcare fraud. And I would point the court to four pieces of evidence in particular to support that conclusion. First, Marino recruited those patients not based on any known or perceived need for medical care, but instead on their access to Medicare funds. Second, she was paid not by the patient, but by the service, and only if Medicare paid for the service. Third, the government put on evidence from which the jury could have concluded that she was aware that the doctor was prescribing treatments that the patient self-evidently did not need. And fourth, she participated in a cover-up and in a manner consistent with the directions that her co-conspirator gave her for the cover-up.
Can you elaborate a little bit more on the third one there? You said that she was aware that people were going and the doctors were prescribing something they didn't need. Can you give me examples?
Yes. Well, O'Brien testified that Marino stayed with her patients just like O'Brien did, because both of them wanted to make sure that somebody else didn't steal their patients while they were there. O'Brien testified that she could see that Glazer was not giving medical exams and that people were getting prescribed wheelchairs that she could see they were fully mobile. And if O'Brien knew that information, there was evidence that Marino was closer to Epitician than O'Brien was. A reasonable jury could definitely have inferred that Marino would have had that same knowledge.
So O'Brien actually testified that, you know, when she was asked, I think, that if she would be paid for MRI if the patient did not actually have an MRI, she answered no to that, ER 455. So, you know, I've tried to look at the record and try to find examples of O'Brien. I understand that you know, we don't have Marino test by him, right? So just assuming for the sake of argument that O'Brien and Marino are fungible, and if we were to see something for O'Brien, it would apply to Marino, which I'm not sure is true, but just assuming that. I'm struggling to find in the record where O'Brien talked about being aware of having, of somebody actually, something getting charged to Medicare that they knew wasn't done. It seems most that your argument about the wheelchair, I don't know if I know, you know, if somebody goes to a doctor and they get a wheelchair, I don't know if I have the judgment to know whether that's medically necessary or not. I struggle a little bit more with if they're getting something that they, if they're actually getting something, but arguably it's medically unnecessary. That's harder for me to see how the government has proven that that person knew that there's Medicaid fraud. If there's evidence that Marino or even O'Brien knew that stuff was being billed for that actually wasn't happening, that seems to me that would be evidence you could rely on. But I haven't seen that, and I don't see that evidence in the record. So can you point me to some of that?
I think the most powerful evidence is about the wheelchairs and how the wheelchair prescriptions were given. O'Brien did testify, I believe, that on occasion patients were asked to sign documents ahead of time. I'm looking for.
I remember seeing that. I do. You don't need to find it because I remember seeing that, and I thought, well, that was actually the closest thing. You get on the clean, but you know, that's also. I could see O'Brien thinking that you know, you sign something, and that'll save the. You know, when we go to the doctor's office, they hand us a pile of stuff and you sign a whole bunch of pages, and it's not clear to me that your average lay person, so to speak, would know that there's some sort of fraud going on by the fact that the doctor wants you to sign 47 things, you know, maybe in what's more efficient for the doctor's office than maybe the order you should sign them. So I thought about that, and it's still hard for me to see how that necessarily is evidence of fraud. The wheelchair thing I'm struggling with because my thought would be, man, our government's sure paying for a lot of stuff that I'm not sure is necessary, but I still don't know. I mean, none of us think the government's that efficient, right? Like, so that's my struggle. Am I hearing you right, though, that you can't point me to anything in the record that actually is O'Brien or Marino, but I think O'Brien knowing that there were things billed for that actually did not happen? Is that would be a silver bullet for me.
Yeah, I don't know that I can point you to those. I think it is more that O'Brien was aware that they were billing for treatments that the patients didn't need. And for example, it's the back and forth with O'Brien and Avetisian where O'Brien testifies that initially Blazer just gave people wheelchairs, but so many wheelchairs were being returned because people didn't need them, that he then began to at least ask the patient if they wanted a wheelchair. And then Avetisian told O'Brien that they weren't getting paid for by Medicare for wheelchairs anymore, so they were going to move to home health care. Again, that has nothing to do with what the patients need. It only has to do with what Medicare would pay for, which would certainly set off alarm bells for the average person.
Yeah, I guess I'm just thinking like in WIC programs, you know, you get so much peanut butter, so much cheese, so much cereal, so all these things. You get these things kind of, and so your average person that knows about these kind of government programs might think, yeah, this is just like a government program that's not necessarily very efficient or very, but it just isn't necessarily illegal or fraudulent that these things are being, you know, just like this person keeps getting peanut butter and they don't use peanut butter, but it's not illegal that they're getting peanut butter. That's the difficulty I'm having for a lay person. I understand it may be different for a doctor, but for a lay person to know that.
I just think even for a layperson to be bringing patients in based on the Medicare rules, to be paid by the service, to see that people who are too healthy and fine are getting prescribed wheelchairs and home health care service suggests that there is a fraud scheme going on. And if she didn't have full knowledge of it, although I think the government has put on evidence that she did have actual knowledge, there certainly was.
So I think that has to be your argument. If that's your argument, then basically, I think your argument is very close to, if not, that is like you're participating in a kickback scheme as a as a, I forget what they call them, you're a marketer. If you're participating as a kickback scheme and a marketer, you are automatically sort of deemed aware of the fraud. I don't know.
I think there's more to it than that in this particular case. Again, if it were just a kickback scheme, one would think she would be getting paid by the patient. But she's not. She's getting paid by the service, and if Medicare doesn't pay for it,
the other way, counsel, if you said she's getting paid by the patient, that's evidence that, like, it's just a treadmill, or, but she's actually getting paid by the service, as I recall correctly. She's actually getting paid, you know. See, she doesn't get paid a kickback based on a wheelchair unless somebody actually gets a wheelchair. And that's, I guess, what I'm getting at. That's a difficulty with me knowing for sure that there's fraud, unless you assume that she's got good judgment as to what's actually medically necessary. And that's tough.
But she's bringing people in off the street who have no known or perceived medical need. There's no connection for the people that she's bringing in that there's any reason for them to be coming to see a doctor. She promised them shoes, diabetic shoes, but she doesn't know whether any of them have diabetes. She knows that there, we could infer, Marino obviously didn't testify, we could infer that she knows that they're going to get asked if they want a wheelchair, but she can see them walking up and down the stairs or walking down the street just fine. She's approaching them in grocery stores and restaurants. That doesn't suggest that there's any medical need for these patients to come in.
Counsel, is there any evidence that she knows that these people are actually getting prescriptions for wheelchairs and at the same time knows they don't need them? Like if she went to a public park and saw some people playing a pickup game of soccer, and she calls them over and asks them, would they go to Dr. Glazer's office to get some Medicare benefits? And later she finds out these soccer players are getting wheelchairs. Is there any evidence like that? I'm not saying it would, that you need evidence like that. Is there anything where she's supposed to be able to tie what she knows to the fact that there's been a prescription for something the person doesn't need?
I think O'Brien's testimony that she was aware that people were getting wheelchairs and home health care services who were mobile, who could leave the house, who could walk fine, is evidence that Marino would have had that same knowledge. O'Brien could see that disconnect. And jury could infer that Marino, who also stayed with her patients, would have had that same knowledge and would have seen this disconnect.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
As to Glazer, the government also put on ample evidence that Glazer was a participant in the conspiracy to commit healthcare fraud, such that any errors at trial were either harmless or didn't rise to the level of plain error. And I point the court in particular to three pieces of evidence related to O'Brien, or to Glazer. The first one is O'Brien's testimony. She testified about the fact that in Glazer's office, people received testing before they ever saw the doctor, that Glazer didn't perform any exams, that he saw patients in his office. She testified about the way they changed the questions about the wheelchair and the home health care, depending on what Medicare paid, and not based on patient need. The second is, in addition to the patients, family members and doctors came in and testified that patients received treatment or were prescribed treatment that they either never received or didn't need. And the third is the financial relationship between Glazer and Avetisian, that Glazer claims that he was paying for fixed costs of rent and staff salaries, but instead his payments to Avetisian varied every month depending on how much money he was making from Medicare. I'm sorry, Judge Owens, I think you were muted.
I was. There was a siren in the background. Sorry about that. I'm sorry, I'm going to jump back to a Marino if I can for a second, because I'm just, a dual instruction was given, or I think we now call it deliberate ignorance. Getting back to Judge Van Dyke's question, when you have marketer plus a dual instruction, that seems to be cutting it very close. And to the idea that basically if you're a marketer accepting kickbacks, plus Juul equals healthcare fraud. And I'm just wondering, are there, I know you cite, I know our circuit has approved the Juul instruction in certain contexts, but in a marketing context, have you seen other cases where the prosecution has taken a marketer plus Juul and had a conviction upheld for healthcare fraud? Because it's a general verdict, right? So we don't know what the theory was that the jury came back on.
Correct. I don't know of a specific case that was focused on kickbacks. In Walter E. Z., the court did find a deliberate ignorance instruction was appropriate, where the defense was specifically that the defendant was caught up, was just caught up in a scheme and didn't have the intent to, it didn't have the intent to commit fraud. We thought that this court thought deliberate ignorance instruction was appropriate there. It seems appropriate here, especially where Marino was put on notice, when the FBI, when there was an investigation of the clinic and Fifth Avenue, and she was told clearly to not bring patients in and to cover up her actions. She clearly knew something was going on. She could have asked at that point in time what was happening, and gotten information about whether or not she was engaged in.
Isn't the challenge with that? I mean, she might know that kickbacks, I don't think her attorney's going to acknowledge that, but she might know that kickbacks are illegal and she might know she's been doing it. But, and so she might think, oh no, but that would be consistent with why she, and so she wouldn't investigate because she know that the government might be investigating and she's doing kickbacks.
Yes, but it also is at some point in time when you've discovered that you're part of a larger illegal activity, which is what it appeared to be when they're doing a big investigation of Blazers Clinic and Fifth Avenue. At that point in time, it starts to seem awfully like deliberate ignorance to not find out whether your actions, even with a kickback actions, to ask any questions about what you're involved in and whether it's illegal. And if she had asked, she would have found out about the broader fraud. And again, there was indications that she would have learned from Avetisian that Glazer was making his referrals, again, based on what Medicare would pay and not on what the patients needed, which would have put her on notice that this was not about medical need, as is the fact that she was asked to bring patients in, not because they had any particular medical treatment. They didn't say, look for people who have canes or people who have difficulty seeing or people who have difficulty walking. None of that. It was just find us people who have access to Medicaid funds.
Well, what is the evidence in general that supports that one should infer that Marino knew what this other person, Davidian, I guess, knew?
I think there's evidence that she would have known at least what O'Brien knew because O'Brien testified that Marino had been working with Avetisian for a longer time. She was unhappy. Marino was unhappy when O'Brien came in because she thought she would take patients away. And in fact, Marino got paid more than O'Brien did because she'd been with Avetisian longer, which suggested that it would be unusual that she would be revealing this information to O'Brien and not to somebody that she'd had a longer and generally closer relationship with at that point in time.
Okay, thanks.
Again, on with respect to Glazer, we believe that the government's evidence is sufficiently overwhelming that any errors are harmless error or don't rise to the level of being plain error. As we said with Marino, we believe that the evidence was sufficient. None of the errors, again, rise to the level of being reversible error. But does the court have any further questions?
I don't. Judge.
No. Thank you.
No other questions?
No more questions from any of us.
Thank you, Your Honor. If the court has no further questions, the government would ask that you affirm.
Thank you. And now we'll turn to Mr. Gunn. And Mr. Gunn's clock says a minute 49. But I've said if he needs a minute or two more, then I'll give it.
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple points. First of all, there was some discussion of the deliberate ignorance and intent to defraud instructions. And of course, those applied to Dr. Glaser as well. And those also mix into the error. So that's a couple more errors added into the evidentiary errors. The government's overwhelming evidence just doesn't fly. A cooperating witness like Zoilo O'Brien is not overwhelming evidence because a jury could always decide she's saying what the government wants to hear because she wants to get a better sentence. That may be evidence that's sufficient to get past Jackson versus Virginia, but it's not overwhelming evidence that makes error not plain or harmless. The family members and doctors that were referenced, they were only about two or three or maybe four patients had family members and doctors in there. And at least one of the doctors, his testimony was particularly vague about whether he really would have prescribed something. So I don't think that carries the ball for the government in terms of the harmless error, plain error hurdles. The financial relationship I talked about in my earlier argument. That may not be the most typical business arrangement, but you had a business manager who came in and explained it. So I don't think you can call that overwhelming evidence where a jury had to accept the government's theory of it. An equally valid theory is that what the business manager said in his testimony, that Dr. Glaser was basically not doing very well financially, that a Batisian came in and said, hey, I'll be your office manager and fund this for you, and you pay me back as the Medicare funds come in, so you're able to pay me back. That's totally consistent with the evidence and also consistent with Dr. Glaser's innocence if a Batisian is doing all this fraud and fakery on the sly without letting him know about it, including using tracing the light box to trace signatures of his on forms. So it just seems to me that, yes, everything the government pointed to is a reason I can't come in and argue Jackson versus Virginia insufficient evidence. But it's not something the government can use to say these multitude of errors were harmless and or didn't affect substantial rights. Unless the court has questions, I'll submit the matter.
Judge Owens?
Thank you. I have one question that I'll ask Paige, and then I'd like to hear the other counsel talk about it and answer the same question. Is there examples where somebody came in that was one of these marketing people come in and they come in for a visit? I assume that the doctor gets to charge Medicare for just the visit itself. But is there examples that they kind of got a clean bill of health and left and there was nothing other than just the visit charged? Or because this goes a little bit, I guess, to the government's theory that you should have, you know, the marketer should have known that something was going on. So
I'm glad Your Honor asked that because it shows how the errors are intertwined here. There wasn't evidence like that because evidence, the court may recall, of legitimate medical services was excluded. The defense wasn't allowed to put on that evidence. And that's one of the errors that we're raising. And that's really critical here because imagine this practice going on over 6 or 7 years. Imagine how many patients came in. And imagine the suspiciousness of the government pulling in records and evidence about just 12 or 13 of those patients out of what must have been hundreds, maybe 1,000 or more. And that's why the exclusion of the legitimate medical services was problematic here. Because the government's whole theory was that everyone was fraud, but the defense didn't get to put on any contrary evidence. So that's my thought on that, Your Honor.
I don't have any more questions, Judge Gould.
Thank you. We'll proceed to Mr. Robbins.
Thank you. There was no evidence that Ms. Marino knew about any of the billings, knew about any of the method in which the billing took place. The government had the opportunity by putting Zoila O'Brien on the stand and asking her specifically the type of questions that you've been asking my colleague from the government about what evidence there was that Ms. Marino knew about this false billing scheme. If I may, with respect to Judge Van Dyke's questioning about what is medically necessary, that was part of the theory of the government's fraud case, that some of these bills were for services that were not medically necessary as defined by the Medicare regulations. The government had to, Mrs. Marino is not a provider, she's an aider and abettor, she doesn't have any duty to vouch for the medical necessity, nor would she ever, because there's no way that she would know. But the government had to put an expert witness on the stand to describe what was medically necessary under those regulations and what wasn't. And it came out very clearly that these Medicare regulations apply differently around the country. What is medically necessary in New York City may not be medically necessary in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And that because there were so many disagreements with respect to the reimbursement for those services, there was an internal appellate process by which the doctors, the providers, could litigate within that framework what was medically necessary and what wasn't. The reason that the government's argument in their rebuttal, primarily where they collapse deliberate ignorance and this lowered willfulness standard to make it to make the argument that, well, she should have seen that there was something going wrong, and from that the jury could extrapolate that she's guilty of this discreetly indicted healthcare fraud, is what's wrong with this prosecution. We asked for a willfulness standard out of the carve-out in Bryan that refers right back to Ratzlaff and Cheeks, where when the criminal liability flows from regulated conduct, the government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant understood what that regulated conduct was and that they were acting illegally, because otherwise an innocent person will be ensnared. Because, as you said, Judge Van Dyke, what may appear to be innocent conduct to the layperson, when we're dealing with regulated criminal conduct, to prosecute them under that theory ensnares the innocent. And so, again, for that reason, along with the other reasons that I've cited in my presentation in our briefs, the government didn't prove, and they had every opportunity to do this, but they never did, that Ms. Marino knew anything about the billing, knew anything about medical necessity, or had any real connection with Dr. Glazer. She didn't even know him. She was a marketer, and that's it. And for those reasons, I'd ask the court to find that there was insufficient evidence to support the discreetly pled healthcare fraud in this case, and if not, that this prosecution was on a constructively amended theory of prosecution that did not comport with what the grand jury had returned, and for the instructional error on its own, particularly the intent to deceive or cheat, relating back to the statements Ms. Marino made to the agent, which were only about her kickback, colloquially, activity post the execution of search warrants. And again, she's charged as an aider and abettor, and the government must prove before she engages and the conduct to facilitate the crime that she had an opportunity to leave because she knew that it was illegal. And for those reasons, we would ask that her convictions be reversed. And I'll submit it unless there's any additional questions.
Any further questions from my colleague? Hearing none, I think your case is now submitted. But before we end, I have a question for Ms. Hostetler. It relates to Mr. Gunn's rebuttal argument. There was one point that Mr. Gunn advocated that I'm sure is proper rebuttal at some level of generality of something you said, but I didn't recall your specificity, if there was any on this point, and that concerned the fact that his client couldn't put in evidence of legitimate services that were covered with these patients. And so I guess I'd like to hear the government's position as to why that should be so. And then I'll give Mr. Gunn 30 seconds to rebut whatever you say.
Yes. Ordinarily, this court has held that evidence of legitimate services are not admissible evidence to determine whether there was unlawful conduct in the cases before the court. And that's the case here. Mr. Gunn refers to the assembly line of fraud, but that wasn't about whether there were ever any legitimate cases. In fact, Glaser put on testimony from two character witnesses, Markowitz and Saratan, that said they got good medical care from Glaser. This is like the Herzog case. In that case, this court said it's not just you don't get to put on evidence of the fact that the defendant in some case correctly reported his income from the sale of a car. The question is whether in these cases before us, the defendant correctly reported the income from the sales of the car. And the assembly line of fraud does not mean that there was never any legitimate services. What it means is there were a lot of different steps in the process. So you had to have the marketer, you had to have the doctor, you had to have the home health care aid, you had to have the durable medical equipment folks. It's the streamlining. It's not that there can never be an individual patient.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Sussman. I appreciate that. Now, Mr. Gunn, if I remember my civil procedure right, I should perhaps give you 30 seconds to rebut what Ms. Hostetler just said.
Your Honor, the case law says that it's generally not admissible, and it is admissible when the government's theory is an overall scheme of fraud. I don't think you can read. I cite to the opening statement of the government, and I cite to the closing argument of the government several places. I don't think you can fairly read assembly line of fraud in the way that opposing counsel suggested. I think what it means, at one point the language is assembly line of fraud to cheat Medicare out of millions and millions of dollars. It's, I think, crystal clear from the record in this case that the government's theory was that everything in there was fraud. The witnesses that she referred to were actually character witnesses. And in one instance, the witness said, well, he shut the door when he saw my mother, which rebutted Zoilo O'Brien saying he always left the door open. But I don't think the court excluded evidence of legitimate medical services. All it allowed was character testimony. And this one witness, I believe, sort of touched on that. The other witness talked about seeing Dr. Glaser at Dr. Glaser's home or something, not at the clinic. Look at the record and what they say about assembly line of fraud. I don't think you can read it the way the opposing counsel is suggesting.
Thanks, Mr. Gunn. Well, I thank my colleagues for indulging me and counsel for further enlightening me. Unless Judge Owens or Judge Van Dyke have more, these cases will now be submitted. And once more, I'm going to thank Ms. Hostetler, Mr. Gunn, and Mr. Robinson for their fine arguments. The Marino and Glaser cases are now submitted for the panel, and you will hear from the panel in due course.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That ends our cases for discussion today. So unless there's something I'm missing, the gavel should tell us that we're adjourning for the day.
This court for this session stands adjourned.